Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in Berkeley, California. And as always, I am joined by
Bob Bazanko in Niles, Ohio.
And today we're very excited. We have a guest that we've studied and followed for a long time, and happy to be joined today by George Katsafikas, who is academic and an author. He's the author of many books, including The Imagination of the New Left and The Subversion of Politics, and a great book, which I believe was your first book, which was Asia's Unknown Uprisings. For years, Professor Katsafikas taught at Boston's Wentworth Institute of Technology in Boston, and has studied in Europe and Korea. And so we're going to get into that. But the main thing that we want to talk about today, which is, I think, a phenomenon happening around the world, is that we're seeing a lot of uprisings in Asian countries, and it's spreading to other parts of the world, like Madagascar, for instance. But we've seen these Gen Z uprisings in Nepal and Indonesia and Bangladesh and places like that. And so Professor Katsafikas is a scholar on something known as the Eros effect, which we're going to talk about a little bit. And maybe you'd like to just start with, for our audience that's not familiar with the Eros effect, talk about the concept of it, and then also how it has this relationship with mass political awakenings. And we can talk about in the context of the recent movements in Nepal, Bangladesh, Indonesia, the Philippines, Madagascar, etc.
That's quite a list, and it's not even a complete one.
Yeah, exactly.
Paraguay, Peru, all kinds of places erupting simultaneously. How do we understand it? And first of all, please call me George. I'm no longer a professor. I don't like to be called an academic, but it's okay. I understand. I think of myself as an activist intellectual. And when the movements of the 60s and early 70s collapsed internally, spread throughout the system in another way, I was faced with a dilemma because I had invested the better part of my adult life in being an activist and had no idea what to do as things changed. And I happened to be very lucky to meet Herbert Marcuse through my activism around the Vietnam War. And he was very supportive of the anti-war movement. And he advised me to come back to the university. I was very reluctant. I had graduated from MIT from solitary confinement for anti-war stuff. And I hated the university system. But slowly I came to realize that maybe that was a better path for me to take. So as I was writing my doctoral dissertation, I did research, as you mentioned, in Germany and traveled throughout Europe and Middle East, and was sitting in an apartment in Ocean Beach, California, with my research notes and overlooking the Pacific Ocean. And all of a sudden, when looking through notes and then turning this page and looking at that and then looking at this book and looking at that, I realized the movement was an international movement, but that the specific eruptions that occurred took place in relationship to each other, and not to the many social movement theories that I had been studying in graduate school. For instance, the age cohort. Sure, that's something, but it doesn't explain the simultaneous eruptions, or resource mobilization doesn't explain it, or contagion theory, Le Bon, which basically looked at uprisings, movements as illnesses. In fact, many of the social movement theories looked at movements as illnesses, short-circuiting, in words of Neil Smelser. And I came up as a student of Marcuse and friend of his, the idea of eros, political eros. I was running combinations of words through my head, and my good friend Rick Nadeau, who lived in the same building, I just walked down the hall, knocked on his door, explained what I was trying to name, and he said, Eros effect, clearly. And that's how the name came about. So what happens when a society based on competition, hierarchy, patriarchy, racism, suddenly turns into a society based on cooperation, solidarity, anti-racism, anti-patriarchy. How do we understand that? That's a very important thing because it is essentially what freedom looks like. That is lived freedom in my understanding. Freedom is not an abstract concept, but it's lived in people's everyday lives. And when everyday life becomes imbued with these other values, like I say, cooperation, not competition, equality, not hierarchy, sharing, not capitalism, anti-racism, solidarity, anti-patriarchy. These are beautiful moments, and they occur without real warning to world leaders. Charles de Gaulle on New Year's Address 1968 said, in a world full of trouble, something like this, France is a beacon of stability. And then in May 68, there was arguably a near revolution, 9 million workers on strike, the campuses on strike, fighting in the streets of Paris and many cities, etc.
So these are spontaneous, right? But and by that, do you mean is in the sense there's no centralized authority creating these, that there's global communication where people are saying, hey, they're doing this in Paris, they're doing this in Prague, this is what's happening in Vietnam, this is what's happening in Havana, and they're interpreting it in their own lives?
Yes, I would say so. Of course, years, decades of organizing precede such eruptions of groups formulating small newspapers, pamphlets, talking, discussions. But although the new media, television, and new social media have a lot to say about it, I found that the Eros effect had occurred in 1848 in the world. There were uprisings all over Europe, as is well known, but in many other countries. 1905, where we know about the Russian uprising, but there were in Iran, there are councils that formed in many countries, as I talk about in my book on the global imagination of 1968. So even without the new media, there were ways of the world spirit, if I may use that word, intervening in history. And there, people don't want us, we materialists today, believing in forces at work, don't like to think of the word spirit, but I think we've seen that now with Gen Z. It's not simply people an uprising in one place and then copying it. No, this is a mood. It's a shift in Gen Z's action. The Washington Post recently had nothing good to say about Gen Z. They were selfish, self-involved, didn't care about the rest of the world. And this has proven that wrong. It's something about human nature. Humans, I believe, as Marcuse said, there is a biological basis to freedom. What does that mean? That means take any human being, or for that matter, even some animals, I think, and cage them, and they will long to get out, to become able to do what they want. And the cage can be invisible. It can be like the gilded cage that many women are forced into through marriage. And it can be invisible racism that is visible in other ways, but these kinds of cages, like in Madagascar, not having electricity or water as guarantees of life, it's the eruption that came directly from that, but it also has a spiritual element of the people wanting to take their lives into their own hands.
Speaking of the 60s, I was wondering what role you think material conditions had in that. Look at like the U.S. and you have, for instance, SDS, which was one of the major groups, right? This is mostly middle class college kids, right? Or you have intellectuals and kind of bourgeoisie. Is there one of the kind of preconceptions that there's material precarity that, you know, or is this more kind of, as you point out, freedom or a sense of ennui or what's the role of kind of materiality in this?
I'm glad you asked because the 60s occurred at a time of unprecedented prosperity in the United States. And so in other places like Madagascar, as you say, it's the lack of basic services. But the Eros effect, let's say, goes beyond such explanations in the material world. In my study of 10 countries in Asia, I found 5 different religions. I can't remember the number, 9 different languages, very different development scenarios taking place. And none of them explained why these uprisings from 1986, when Marcos was overthrown in the Philippines, 1987, when the Chundukwan regime came to an end, to Burma, 1988, Tibet, China, 1989, Taiwan, 1990, Thailand, 1992. And I traveled to all of these countries and spoke with people who had been involved in the movements. And they all pointed to other examples that had motivated them to act, especially the Gwangju uprising of 1980. In fact, in Nepal, which I didn't mention a second ago, I met the president of the country, President Yadav, and I met the head of the Communist Party, Marxist-Leninist, at that time. And they had both traveled to Gwangju and knew about Gwangju and the uprising. I talked with someone who had been in Tiananmen Square in China in 1989, right? And he said that this photo book of Gwangju had been ripped apart and plastered on all the great walls, the walls where people put up posters that they would read. And it was photographs of the uprising and the democratic spirit gathering at the fountain, marching in contingents. And it became a model for people in China. Not to say that it was the exact model. It's not a quick recipe for what to occur, but that the influence of one revolt on another is one of the primary driving forces of social movements. It's something that really hadn't been at that time theorized.
And with what we're seeing now, it's very similar going from Nepal, chronologically, I think it's Bangladesh to Indonesia, to Nepal, to Madagascar, many others, as you say. But it's the same phenomenon happening, is that there.
I agree totally, although I would say it began in Sri Lanka some years before, 4 years before, as I recall.
2021, I think.
I recently published something in the Colombo Telegraph, and I titled it Sri Lankan Gen Zers, Look What You Began, just to give them some encouragement to keep going. Not that they need it. They're doing very well.
One thing I'm curious about with this current sort of wave of uprisings and revolts is that what sort of precedes them, like precedes Sri Lanka in 2021, is COVID, which was also this global phenomenon where in many places people were sheltered in place and there was all this panic or at least anxiety around vaccines and getting sick and things like that. Does that factor into any of these?
It's a good question. COVID certainly had a huge effect on people's lives, everyday lives. The isolation, I think, that was imposed by quarantines especially. But I'm not sure how we can understand its relationship to the Gen Z uprisings. I'd have to really look into it more.
Once these uprisings occur and they have this, you have this kind of surge of participation, and again, this is more of a historical framework, do they continue? Do they last? Or one of the historians who's influenced me a great deal is Arno Mayer, which we talked about the prisoners of the old regime. Gabriel Kolko wrote about that too, right? How the ruling class kind of retrenches and then recasts society, retakes. Do these movements do they endure, or is there a backlash and they're back to where they started?
The natural history theory of revolution has the summer of intense activity and fall of the movement falling back, winter of standstill, and spring of the old regime reasserting its power. I don't know that there is much validity to such models. There is certainly, however, as you said, the ruling groups are not willing to give up control and they find new ways of maintaining control. And they don't lose their wealth in very few examples. They want to hold on to it, obviously. But I'm not sure that the movements can be said to evaporate. Let's look at a recent movement that many people think has evaporated, Black Lives Matter. It was a huge movement in its mobilization. It's been said that it was the largest mobilization in the history of the United States. And it had an enormous impact. And of course, its leadership took the profits, financial profits, from what was given to the movement. And I think that was a big setback for the movement. But I think it's going to happen again, something like that, because the material conditions of police violence, it's like more than three people every day are killed by police in the United States. And when I say that in other countries, people, there's disbelief, because the image of the United States has been one, until now, has been one of great prosperity, America, everyone seems to know someone or has family in the United States and hears really good things about it, which on a material level is basically true. A technological level is true. But in terms of spiritual development, in terms of cultural development, I think the United States is lacking in real progress. Will these revolts now, Gen Z revolts, continue? It's my fervent hope, and I believe that in many countries that have yet to be heard from, we are going to see similar uprisings of young people, of the Gen Zers, for whatever reasons, congealing together globally. I don't have a crystal ball, but if I did, I'd say I see that coming.
Yeah, because one thing I'm curious about, you in your writing, you talk about five or six examples of the Eros effect in the last, since 1968. And one of which is the Arab Spring, Indignados, Occupy period, 2011. That goes from Arab Spring to European Summer to American Fall. And I'm curious, because we're such a much more, information-wise, so much more of a globalized world, and information travels so much faster. Is that what we're going to see? And just to note it, we just had this huge mobilization here in the U.S. over the last weekend, No Kings. And there were people who had the Straw Hat Jolly Rogers flags, which is like what we've seen in some of these. You have one. In some of these, we've seen in Indonesia and Nepal and things like that. And so I'm curious what you're thinking is on that.
I commented to a friend that this flag is the embodiment of the Eros effect. It's right. Information spreads so quickly, simultaneously, even nowadays. Sadly, the media are in the hands of the wrong people. We know this. And Mark Zuckerberg has done a tremendous job censoring Palestinian reality from his networks. And Paramount, which owns CBS, owns the whole thing, they're similarly openly pro-Zionist, openly disturbing, destroying global communication and balancing it in favor of people who are committing genocide. A country that's, the soldiers do yoga in the morning and kill in the afternoon. It's like crazy.
In the 60s, and I keep going back to this because it's an area I've taught about and written about, these movements occurred when the Cold War is, in many ways, that at its apex. And there is a kind of a countervailing force. Even if these movements aren't directed by socialists or communists, there is this reality that you have the Soviet Union and China as countervailing forces, and places like Vietnam and Cuba, it's very relevant. Does the kind of downfall of that around 1990 make it more difficult because there isn't the same global conflict, the same global contest? And so the ruling class doesn't really have those same barriers to repression, to doing what it wants to do, because there isn't this kind of, the Soviet Union or China or these indigenous left movements aren't as powerful as they were in 1968.
The heroic resistance of the Vietnamese people is remarkable, and that really was the catalyst of the global uprising. As I see the world, Russia and China are still being attacked by the United States. The forms are different. And as much as we say Trump is pro-Putin, he's not. He might like the person, but in terms of Russia and China, he's definitely fighting a different kind of war against those countries. Now, Russia is not the Soviet Union. It's not communist by any stretch of the imagination. China, arguably, is communist. It is run by the Communist Party, and there are some radical forces within the Communist Party. But I think since we had the transition to capitalism, it is... What would he say? Joyful to be rich, it is, you know what I'm talking
to be
about.
Rich is glorious, I think.
There it is, glorious.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
And Chinese young people that I have interacted with all say that prosperity is this generation's or this era's task of China, that once China, and they have of it, I think China liberated 300 million people from absolute poverty. And that's more than half of the number of people liberated from absolute poverty in the world in this period of time, the last three decades. It's an enormous achievement. And I would say it has something to do with the socialist character of the economy. That conflict is still there, I think. And I think on the better side, I think the very dogmatic Marxist-Leninist groups that collapsed SDS, PL, the Progressive Labor Party, no longer have the appeal to young people that they did in the 60s, but especially at the end of the 60s. There's a story, I wasn't there, I've heard it from several people. The last convention of SDS, people were standing on chairs screaming, the RIM faction, Revolutionary Youth Movement factions, screaming, Ho Chi Minh, NLF is going to win. And the other side was screaming, Mao Zedong, revolution by the young. And then the debate, when things calmed down, and the speakers from PL said that Albania is an example of revolutionary socialism, someone in the back of the room screamed, what's the capital of Albania? Nobody would.
Well, see, what we have today, at least in the U.S., is you have people on the left who are saying the same thing that NATO and the NSC are saying, right? They're attacking Cuba. They're attacking China. They're pro-Ukraine war, right?
Yes.
And that's in the 60s, it seemed like there was at least this kind of consensus on certain issues, right? Imperialism is bad, and we're against the U.S., what the U.S. is doing in Cuba, what the U.S. is doing in Vietnam, and a ton of other places. And it seems like that after 1968, that's become harder to develop, right? That kind of, that ideological solidarity, I guess I might call it.
Yes, if anything, the new ideology of young people is anarchism. There's a lot of anarchism in theory and even more in practice. As we said, leaderless movements, spontaneously generated, autonomously managed, believing in absolute freedom of the individual, freedom of the group. So these principles of anarchism from Bakunin or Kropotkin might not be known by Gen Zers in Asia, I don't know, but certainly not a big bunch of people use any ideology except the ideology of freedom. And speaking of freedom, that's also an anarchist concept, really.
Well, and the right wing in the U.S. has used that really effectively. We're not going to wear masks, and we're not going to get vaccinated, and because of our freedom, I don't want to wear seatbelts or whatever. And the left has really missed out on that, I think.
And you make a good point that now in the United States, there's a very large right wing that is much better organized than I think we understand in organizations that will use any tactics they want to and really get away with it. We saw it with Trump releasing all of the people who had been taken years to put in jail because of the attack on the U.S. government that he led. I wonder if the mobilizations in the United States become more militant, which is what I think we need in the United States, if the Proud Boys and other right-wing groups will begin attacking the mobilizations. No Kings, as I understand it, is organized by the Democrats. And much as I love Bernie and AOC, I have to say, I think that the large rallies I've noticed, I was at one in San Francisco, not this one, the one before, which would be, I don't remember when.
It was June, I think.
Okay, it was June. People, first of all, abundance of very funny, well-made artistic posters, banners, and it was great networking. It was good to see people. But as soon as the speakers began, people began to leave. Also noticed that people didn't come in contingents, which to me is an indication of the disintegration of American civil society, that people came as individuals. But as much as I love Bernie and AOC, I have read that they spent $15,000 a day jetting around the country for their speaking tour against oligarchy. And that's not a lot of money, but it certainly is not grassroots funded. Certainly there are donors who are contributing heavily. And whenever you have a situation where donors are the ones propelling leaders forward, it's a very dangerous situation for a movement to be in. The other thing that worries me about the movement in the United States are people who are not of the movement, by the movement, or really for the movement, speak increasingly for the movement. I'm not just talking about Hakeem Jeffries or the Senator Schumer. I'm talking about journalists. And Vincent Bevins did an excellent book called When We Burn or If We Burn, which I read carefully. And he spoke with activists in half a dozen countries and got to know the movements. But he comes to the conclusion that what we need are centralized organizations, which is where the 60s ended up and where the movement was eviscerated by such groups within the movement. Chris Hedges, he absolutely detests militant street protests. And he said, Crime Think's webmaster, Brian, and he had a tremendous debate. And Brian wiped him out, but Chris Hedges continues to speak against militant actions. I think it's a real problem because I think they have credibility. They have a readership. They have a large following based on their access to not only media, but to good writing, clear, concise writing.
I think it's in the last month, the Trump administration has come out and said that the new terrorist boogeyman is Antifa or anti-fascists. And Hedges in particular, but I would say Vincent Bevins also embodies this as well, is they add to that the Democrats, who also should not be speaking for the movement, as you said, are trying to distance themselves. And yet the Trump administration has decided the best way to wipe out like grassroots movements and street protests and people who did things during Occupy or did things in 2020. They're the real terrorists, and they're as dangerous as Al Qaeda or whatever it is that they're saying. And the Trump administration is also linking that to donors. We actually just did a panel last night on resisting state repression with Will Potter and some other speakers. And point was made is that they're not necessarily talking about militant anti-fascist groups on the street as much as they're talking about George Soros and right. Tides Foundation and organizations like that.
Trump is really, he's just a loose cannon. And another difference in the 60s was that Nixon worked hand in hand with Hoover and the FBI and the COINTELPRO program, CIA Operation Chaos, targeting activists. Trump is attacking the FBI, or did attack the FBI. And he's actually, even with the person that he's put in charge, Patel, I think the rank and file of FBI agents are very disheartened. They're spending most of their time on immigration issues and not on what they're supposed to be doing, which I don't particularly agree with, but it's very interesting. If you wanted to do a coup d'etat, you'd think you would work well with the CIA and the FBI. But what Trump is focusing on is on the military. He's fired Charlie Brown, the top general, Joint Chiefs. He's weeded out many of the progressives in the military. He's threatening to go after Milley, the former Joint Chiefs chairman, who refused to authorize troops into the streets. So the scenario I see as a real possibility is if Trump doesn't run and he puts up Vance as a shadow candidate, the way Putin did to gain their 5 years there, but if Vance loses, I think it's very highly likely that Trump will leave office. He simply will abandon the White House. And if he doesn't leave on his own, who will get him out of the White House? Not the military run by the terrible War Department leader today.
Hegseth, Pete Hegseth.
Yes, that's because liberals right now are apoplectic about the destruction of the White House for architectural reasons or whatever. To me, the point there is he's not leaving. He's not planning on leaving.
You're right, I think.
I want to get back to, because you mentioned that like at the rallies, you didn't see contingents there. And I went to one, the last one. And I thought the same thing, that you didn't have if I wanted to hate to invoke them, but like the Democrats weren't really there in any organized way. Labor, which has really been absent from pretty much everything. You have local labor councils and like labor in LA, very active. But on a national scale, you're not seeing anything, even from somebody like Sean Fain, who's pro-tariff and really in a lot of ways collaborating. How important is that to have, let's just call it mainstream support? I know in the 60s, which I studied and written about, one thing that was important, even if you didn't like these people, was that folks like Fulbright and military, retired military leaders spoke out against the Vietnam War. You had significant mainstream support of the civil rights movement. It's not a revolutionary movement, but in American terms, equalities, it is very revolutionary. How important is that to have these kind of contingents organized, not necessarily centrally organized, but as a kind of mobilizing force, at least, to bring people out, to get people involved, like the Democratic Party or like labor or maybe a better media?
I think they're extremely important, especially if the goal is to have militant street actions, blockades, for instance, that you need to have affinity groups, but more than affinity groups. You need to have contingents composed of affinity groups. And the only people doing that I understand are the Black Bloc. And the Black Bloc is relatively invisible now. It's a thing of the past in many people's minds. We'll see if that's true. By the way, where did you go to the No Kings rally? In Chicago?
In Ohio. A small town in Ohio, Warren, Ohio. And there were like 1,000 people there. Youngstown, which is right next to me, had 2,500. There are a lot of people out there who want to do something, but there wasn't even somebody like signing up names for emails or anything.
Yeah. What's it going to take to get this movement going? I don't know. I wish I did have the answer, but I think a beginning point is for people to form affinity groups and contingents of affinity groups. And whether those are labor, people at work, you go together to the protest, or people from a neighborhood go together to a protest. And part of the function of these small groups is that if the police do attack the people, they will rescue each other. They will care for each other. They will know what each other's fate is. When you go anonymously and individually to these demonstrations, you're opening up a world of trouble for yourself.
Because you brought up Vincent Bevins, I had a question for you around that. Because I agree that Vincent Bevins argues that the sort of decentralized nature of what we saw in the 2010s around Arab Spring and subsequent movements and moments, that we needed like a centralized, a vanguard sort of thing. And I'm wondering, just to dig into that a little bit deeper, do you because you've written about the success of the Arab Spring, for example, and I'm wondering how you and many things after, but I'm wondering how you see where we had really successful effective movements during that period, during the period in the last 15 years or so.
Well, you mentioned the waves of Eros Effect. Let me recall them. One was the disarmament movement, which preceded the end of the Cold War and had enormous mobilizations in Europe and the United States. And that became a global effort. And that was at the end of the 1980s, as I recall. Then we had the wave of Asian uprisings that I spoke about a minute ago in at least 10 countries. We had the wave of uprisings in Eastern Europe, which many leftists don't like to think of as a liberatory movement, but I believe we need to include it because it reflected people's real needs. Then we have the 2011 wave, Arab Spring, Occupy, and what have I left out?
The Seattle moment.
The ultra-globalization movement, which really was an enormous movement that in part ended or morphed because of the war on Islam, because of the wars that erupted. But even opposing the first Iraq war, we had a mobilization of millions of people across the world with no centralized organization. But to return to this question of centralized organization or not, first of all, there one organization is going to lead movements. The only option is to have many organizations, either in coalition or in practical coordination with each other. In the 60s, the Black Panther Party was a centralized, democratic centralist or centralized organization with cadre structure, hierarchy. And yet it had an enormous impact on the movement as a whole. It was, in my opinion, the most revolutionary organization in the latter part of the 20th century in the United States. An unknown thing that the Panthers did was the Revolutionary People's Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in September 1970. I was happy to be there. Over 15,000 of us made it there. Police blockaded the highways leading in. Buses were stopped and turned around. The Panthers in Philly were arrested, the men stripped naked and run through the streets for a photo op for journalists. Nonetheless, we wrote a new constitution for the United States, which was supposed to be ratified in Washington, D.C. some weeks later. But the new constitution, if you read it, it's beautiful. It starts with the United States should redistribute the resources it's taken from other countries. And it goes through opposition to patriarchy. It goes through, of course, opposition to racism, but it goes to solidarity with Palestine and Vietnam and third world liberation struggles. It goes through students should not have such structures imposed on it, the whole thing. And a particularly insightful one was that the Panthers and the groups endorsed this new drug policy, marijuana, mescaline, LSD, life drugs should be legal. Speed, heroin, cocaine should be eradicated by any means necessary. So it's a very truthful and honest attempt. It's been lost in history. People don't really talk about it much. I do as much as I can, but I'm a small voice and the big voices out there, okay. But so I think there can be many Marxists. Nepal, in the overthrow of the king and the abolition of the monarchy, had at least seven different communist parties, all participating in the movement together. So they would be the contingents that marched together in these mammoth marches. And they coordinated with the Maoists in the countryside, who were waging an armed struggle, so that the Maoists drew the army out of the city because they needed to protect the city. And it was an amazing coordination of different groups, including the Congress Party, which I think probably the best analogy in the United States would be the Democratic Party or the old Democratic Party. I don't know where this Democratic Party is headed. It's just atrocious the way they set limits on young people's participation in the leadership.
You know what? One of the things I think that I noticed, you know, earlier is that there comes a point, and I've actually studied 1968 quite a bit too, specifically the economic crisis of 1968. And there comes a point where the ruling class is afraid because everything is being destabilized. And I think we saw that in 2020 here as well, where in 2020, you know, that summer, you had the military, people like Milley and corporations stepping back and putting up like performative stuff, Black Lives Matter or rainbow flags or something like that. But there was this idea that Trump had disturbed that equilibrium, disturbed that stability. And I think the ruling class in 2020 said, we got to get rid of this guy. That doesn't seem to be the case anymore. What we have now is this kind of total capitulation by these traditional forces like universities, where I just retired after 30 years. Labor, like I said, is basically quiet. How important is it to have that kind of a resistance to destabilizing movements on our own? We can go out in the streets like we do, right? But there's a big difference between what's happening in No Kings rally, and I have no problem with those, and what's happening like in the streets of Chicago right now. Like, how do you bring more people in? Because right now the Democrats are actually a barrier to this, right? They're rejecting it. They're not participating in it, and they're actually actively opposing it. I don't know how many times Democrats have said Antifa is a gift to the right. And I tend to agree with you that anarchists right now are doing the best organizing work.
Well, you said a lot there.
I know, but I guess the issue is like there used to be a time when even the ruling class wanted a stable society. That was as important as profit.
Absolutely. That's why David Rockefeller announced a new American Revolution. And it was coined a term that picked up by Nixon. And that became what's known as neoliberalism in terms of a change of ruling class institutional values. I don't know that 2020 was as a thing, and I don't know that the ruling class wanted Trump out. I think really Hillary and Trump were not that different. Hillary said explicitly, right, in the campaign that she wanted war with the Soviet Union. Somebody said that would be war with I think it came out of Syria. She wanted to fly over Syria. And as you say, now all the big donors, billionaires, seem to be siding with Trump. There's Soros is not. That's true. And that's perhaps why Trump is going after him, because if he can maintain solid support among the wealthy by scaring them, that what will happen to you if you start speaking against me, that is some gain that he will make in his consolidation power, which is what we see happening. So I think the wealthiest individuals are all, they're the ones who are going to fill his ballroom. It's not going to be you and me and the residents of Washington, D.C. They're not going to be, it's going to be his specific people who are brought in.
It's interesting thinking about what's happened in, just to take it back to a little bit of the kind of first question, is thinking about what's happened in these recent uprisings in Asia, Nepal, Madagascar, places like that. It's not really anything that you've heard that much about from Trump. We saw the Eros effect in 2019, where we saw movements in Chile and Colombia, and which led to like more left-leaning governments. And Trump is now definitely like zeroing in on like left governments in South America, Venezuela and Colombia. And do you think they just don't think that what's happened in Nepal and Madagascar really matter that much? It's not that important to their sort of notion of power in the world, or they just don't see it as a threat at this point? It's just like an unstable Asian, small Asian country.
That could
except with the exception of Indonesia, which is a huge country.
Yes. I think Trump is indeed a scared guy in general. Trump always chickens out. I think he's afraid of the example being set in those countries on young people in America. And for him to attack them or give them credence would drive many young people who don't like him into better movement activism, I think. And so I think he's smart to the extent that he ignores them and pretends they don't matter. I don't know if you remember, but Richard Nixon famously watched a football game during the 1969 moratorium as if to say he didn't care. And we know from later released transcripts, the guy was totally paranoid and upset and worried. And in May 70, he even secretly went into the big protests and was in the mind of one person, was in tears talking to the protesters like, why have you all turned against me? So I think, of course, what's going to be the deciding factor is material in the next year, 2 years and 3 years. That is Trump's economic policy really going to work? Is he really going to collect billions in tariffs and not hurt the standard of living of working Americans? Because if it doesn't work, and if inflation, which many people are predicting will again rise, if his plan falls apart in real terms, he's in big trouble, I think. And so
that's what I meant by stability. That was the point, yeah.
If you think about it, how much did he charge for the golden visa? $1 million?
Yeah.
And $1 million times 1 million people is how much money? $1 million?
Yeah.
$1 trillion.
It's $1 trillion. Trillion, right.
That's a lot of money that he would get or the government would get. So I don't know. Are 1 million people going to pay $1 million to get a golden visa to the U.S.? Possible. That's a heck of a lot of money. And he has some very interesting ideas, I think, about getting the corporations maybe to pay down the debt. I think that might be what's coming down the road. We'll see.
He's gunning for that Nobel Prize in economics since he can't seem to get the Nobel Peace Prize.
I can't believe he even thinks he has a chance.
Right. He did get it this year, so. The woman from Venezuela.
We're getting near the end of our time. I had one or two other questions. I don't know if Bob has other questions. I feel like we could just talk for a long time if we put our minds to it. You've studied a lot in South Korea, the Gwangju uprising, massacre movement, and what happened in 1987 in South Korea, which is, and I would actually also say this somewhat applies to what happened in the Philippines in 86. They are these sort of huge moments where they overthrew dictatorships or authoritarian states or what have you. And I'm curious what you've seen with this current sort of wave of Asian uprisings. How much is there influence from that? Do they, I also recognize that Gen Zers may not know their history, but like how much are those, what happened in South Korea and the Philippines in 86, influential today? We, on our panel last night, we actually had a Filipino American woman who actually talked a lot about both Marcos, the father, and the son. So.
In those two specific cases, there were charismatic leaders who played major roles in the movement. Benigno Aquino was assassinated when he returned to the Philippines after spending time in prison. And Kim Dae-jung went on to win a Nobel Peace Prize for his going to North Korea. It so happens that they knew each other in the United States when they were in exile. Benigno Aquino had been released to the United States. Kim Dae-jung's life was saved by the United States when he was on a very small boat being tied up to be thrown into the Pacific. A U.S. helicopter flew overhead and stopped it. And they threatened to take the Olympics away from Chun Doo-hwan if he went ahead with repression of the movement. And they groomed both men to become leaders of their country who would be friendly to the United States, who would not be hostile to the United States. So I haven't seen the emergence of such leaders in some of these Gen Z uprisings or the support. The place, of course, that's so interesting is West Africa. What I'm talking about,
Sudan or?
No, in West Africa.
Oh, wow.
Sudan is East Africa. West Africa, yeah. In Mali, and in, it means land of good people, Burkina Faso. The wonderful president there who went to one of the schools that Thomas Sankara started when he was president before he was assassinated. So you asked about continuity. Schools for young people that are revolutionary based are extremely important for grooming leaders ahead. And I'm a great fan of popular uprisings and movements, but I also believe there is a role for good charismatic leaders to play in helping these movements take power. And sadly, some of them become power hungry. But there are other examples, like Flight Commander Jerry Rawlins in Senegal, who twice pulled coups d'etat and twice stepped down to let the country have democratic elections. Does that answer your question? Because I don't know that those uprisings are fresh in the minds of Gen Zers.
No, absolutely. That's great.
Actually, I do have one last one in. We could talk about an hour just on this, but just briefly. Today, the New York Times had an article which basically talked about the politics of teaching history, which is something obviously very important to me. And I was a professor in Texas for 30 years and finally got out. And Texas is firing professors now. And they're very openly saying there's an ideological litmus test. Have you seen anything like that? And how do you fight against that?
I was fired twice by Wentworth, and twice they didn't fire me. First time, I published an article on torture in Israeli prisons and in the Boston Globe, and my whole humanities and social sciences department turned against me, ostracized me, even gave some of my research papers to the Israeli consulate. But so the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, sent a lawyer from Washington to meet with the administration at Wentworth to get me fired. And they fired me, and the vice president who came over to tell me, told me, and I said, okay. He says, why aren't you protesting? What's the matter? I said, look, John, I have nothing but good evaluations here, excellent evaluations. I write an article in the Boston Globe. You fire me. I take a 2 or 3 year vacation until I get my job back, and you pay me hundreds of thousands of dollars. So you're giving me a great opportunity. He laughed. And he said, wait a minute. And he said, hey, what's the difference between anti-Zionist and anti-Semitic? And I explained it to him. I said, anti-Semitic people don't like Jews and Arabs, the Semites. They're against the Semites. Anti-Zionist is against a specific type of government that is for a certain people only and not for others who live in the country. And he said, okay, wait a minute. And he went over, then my phone rang, and he said, I just wanted to tell you, you're not being fired. And we never had this conversation. And I said, what conversation? I just laughed at him. So then the second time, the police, Boston police, killed a young woman celebrating the victory over the Yankees in the World Series, Victoria Snellgrove. She was shot with a less lethal weapon, which was a small tear gas pellets supposed to be used on a single individual to subdue them, and said they fired it into a crowd. There's a photo of her standing on the sidewalk, not even in the street, smiling and just so happy. Sox fans. And I helped organize professors. And we worked with a student group across Boston. We got that weapon dismissed from police arsenal. But I was on the Emily Rooney show. Andy Rooney's daughter has a show on public television. And so the next day, a different lawyer came to my office and said, don't go to class today. And I said, oh, why? He says, you're being fired. And I said, why? And he said, you were on the Emily show and the board of trustees saw it and they're really angry. They say, you don't have the right to speak for Wentworth. And I said, actually, if you look at the transcript, I explicitly said, I do not speak for Wentworth. I'm just someone who teaches there. He said, you wait here. I'm going to look at the tape. And he came back and said, you're a smart guy. And I said, you know what? You tell the president when you see him that he should give me a raise. He says, what are you talking about? I said, I put Wentworth up there with Harvard, MIT, and all these very good schools. And you're telling me I'm getting fired for that? I got a raise. The president chuckled. But now with Trump collapsing the difference between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, that is a real danger because they can use, law to dismiss professors for breaking the law, for speaking out against Israel. And that to me is something that never should have happened. It kind of went by in a flash. Congress voted without any real debate about it. And that to me is going to be used increasingly against professors.
Well, in Texas, they've been fired for like tweets about Charlie Kirk. So it's moved beyond.
Yeah.
And the Democrats were responsible for this kind of weaponization of anti-Semitism. They did it as much as the Republicans have. And now they've expanded out to, like, you say something about Charlie Kirk, and 170 state employees in Texas have been fired over Charlie Kirk.
It's my understanding that he was a neo-Nazi.
He went after professors like you. He was doxing them. He was threatening them. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I had death threats on my office door.
Yeah.
I had stickers put for this group, the JDL. Put stickers on my desk. And in a locked office, I arrive and there's JDL stickers on my desk.
Sure.
It happens.
Yeah. Unless Bob has any other questions, I'm going to wrap it.
Yeah, we're good. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. I'm been familiar with your work for some time, and I really appreciate the fact that you talk with us.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been great talking with you. Folks, we've been talking with George. This is his, I believe, your most recent book, Heroes and Revolution, but number of great books, including Asia's Unknown Uprisings, 2 volumes, and Subversion of Politics. Highly recommend folks to go out and check out some of that. If you like what you're hearing, please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Blue Sky. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. And if you really like us, go to greenandredpodcast.org and hit the support button or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. And really appreciate you coming on and making the time.
Thank you for having me. May I just mention my website, eroseffect.com?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of free material there.
And we'll put it in the show notes too.
Thanks, Scott.
And everybody else out there, make trouble and misbehave, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks.